Hello, it's the Guardian Film Show ploughing manfully through summer season in its ongoing effort to bring the very best of cinema from around the world. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's more challenging. And this week, it may well be what some refer to as a mission dead tricky.
Benji, open the door! Open the door!
Yeah, I'm trying.
Oh my God!
The other door!
Set to explode on this week's show.
When you fire your weapon, you frighten the game.
You're already frightened. That's why they're being hunted.
Michael Douglas is out hunting big game in Beyond the Reach.
I did not want to have to do this, but you're forcing me to take extreme measures.
Reese Witherspoon is up to all kinds of monkey shines in Hot Pursuit.
Here's my mission to protect you!
And Adam Sandler rediscovers his soul and possibly his tongue in shoe-themed drama The Cobbler. Quite an array of riches then. And yet, before we launch ourselves headlong into all of that, there is the small matter of Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. An evil crime syndicate is hell-bent on killing the British Prime Minister, and only Tom Cruise can save him now.
Benji.
Ethan, where are you?
The syndicate is real.
Ethan Hunt is a rogue agent in a rogue nation, in what may just turn out to be a rogue planet. And it's about to get even worse. Because if Ethan can't defuse that bomb, or ride that motorbike more quickly, or run even faster down that foggy London street, then the mission fails, and the whole galaxy goes rogue.
It's impossible.
Joined by Peter Bradshaw and Henry Barnes. Peter, I sort of slightly worry that I'm coming apart at the seams here, but I kind of enjoyed this.
I did enjoy it, I have to admit. I sort of hate myself a little bit for enjoying it, but I have to say, it's incredible how long running, and the term is appropriate, the Tom Cruise Mission Impossible franchise has been. Nearly 20 years old. Tom is 53 now. He doesn't really look any different from when he started at the age of 33 or 34.
He's looking like a kind of aging televangelist.
He still looks pretty good. I wouldn't mind looking like that. That was amazing. It's reportedly very reliant on new Chinese investment. This new firm called Alibaba Pictures, who've put in an absolute shedload of cash. And if I had to speculate, that accounts for the interesting pro-British Anglophile thing. That's what the Chinese think. They've got this thing that it has to be sort of James Bond with a touch of Harry Potter, with all these locations in London, which are very Harry Potter, and all these phone calls people make from fully functioning red telephone boxes with hardly a dodgy postcard to be seen. Yeah. And that, if I had to guess, is a result of the Chinese producers, who have a rather conservative pro-British view of what action adventure should be like. It may also account for the remarkable boost to Simon Pegg's career, who is now almost really co-star to Tom Cruise. I mean, he's not just the kind of quirky, limey kind of comic foil. Mm. He's really above Jeremy Renner and Ving Rhames, which is kind of incredible for his career. Still, good luck to him.
You got your seatbelt on? You asking me that now?
Oh, hey, boys, what did I miss?
I did quite enjoy it. I do enjoy Tom Cruise's absurd, genuine non-green screen stunts. And they are just so silly, but I do enjoy them, I have to admit.
It makes no sense, but as a series of set pieces, it's perfectly entertaining.
And that's what you want from a great action film, right? Yeah. A series of set pieces, and why not? I mean, I've read people say that the series gets better and better. I wouldn't agree with that. I think Brian De Palma's original is a great film. It's got its cheesy elements, but it's still good. And there was an excellent piece that Amy Nicholson wrote a couple of years ago about Tom Cruise and how he's changed as an actor, mainly because of public perception. And when he went on Oprah and jumped on the sofa, that changed everything. And he was seen in Hollywood as a nutbag who didn't know what he was doing anymore. And that's not true. This is a guy who's still extremely savvy about what his appeal is. He's still, in many ways, the definitive movie star. And he can carry a film like this in his sleep. He's still got amazing charisma. And he is still finding ways of innovating. Like, if you look at Edge of Tomorrow, it was actually a fairly interesting, strange part for him to play in a mainstream action film. So I don't think he's got lazy either. He has got commitment. I would say one thing about all the stunts and that is that the marketing world these days tends to put those things scenes before the movie. So the key scene that we see of him grabbing onto the outside of the plane, we've seen that everywhere on the internet already, which is a shame because it's completely blown its wad for the film itself.
Yeah. But it only happens in the first 5 minutes.
It does, but in a weird way, if that's the thing that you're prepped to look forward to from the film, you'd always expect it to be the climax.
Well, I like the motorbike chase.
The motorbike chase, amazing. Yeah. Still very good.
And also a great part for Rebecca Ferguson.
Yeah, she was good, I thought.
Yeah.
She's a sort of proper old school femme fatale.
She is. She's not a foil and she's not a romantic interest. She has her own role.
We've never met before, right?
Follow me.
A man you can trust. Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation. And after all that intrigue and jeopardy and explosiveness, there's only one place left to go, and that's still further, out there, beyond the reach. Michael Douglas is a butter-fingered big-game hunter who shoots at a sheep and kills an old man instead.
Ben, the situation's more complicated than you think.
Tour guide Jeremy Irvin is the only witness to this terrible tragedy, but that's still one witness too many.
Stop it!
And out in the desert, the hunt starts anew.
No, I'm not killing you. I'm just going to watch you die.
Henry, we were talking a couple of weeks ago when Ant-Man came out that we wanted to see Michael Douglas go bad again, and he's pretty bad here.
He's pretty bad in both senses, I think, in this. He presented this at Toronto last year, and I spoke to him, did a bit of press with him there, and he was saying how it's fun to play a bad guy, and also this film was the film that was going to connect him with young adult audiences. And really? I have no idea how. And it's a really bonkers, weird film in not the best way. There's a bit where he's chasing him around the desert saying, ah ha ha, why won't you die? And I just thought, like, you're really great at signing up for trash, Michael Douglas. You really are.
There's a strange flaw that he kind of lets him go and then decides he wants to kill him.
It is like a Wile E. Coyote, you know, Looney Tunes cartoon. I mean, it's fun in its own way, but it all unravels and falls apart and falls off a cliff.
In terms of the story, this has got a kind of newsworthiness that nobody could have predicted.
It is. It really plays to the horrible image of the American, presumably you're talking to the Minnesota dentist, who put 50K up to kill Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe. I have to say, I did quite enjoy this. In its own bizarre way, it reminded me of the... It's actually from the 70s. It's Rob White's novel, Death Watch. It's from the 70s, and it's from an era, a kind of lost era of Deliverance and Duel and all these things. And it's crazy and silly, and basically Michael Douglas's psychopathic motivation isn't really properly securely established. But for all that, I must say I did quite enjoy it. I did find it quite watchable. It's very silly, and it's got a very stupid coda. After you think it's finished, then it starts all over again, a kind of almost horror movie style kind of corpse rearing up style coda, which I think wasn't necessary. But I have to admit, I did shamefacedly rather enjoy this, and I do rather enjoy Michael Douglas's kind of sleazy, absurd bad guy with his customised Mercedes-Benz in the jungle and his Austrian hunting rifle.
It's got a loophole scope, best glass you can get out of Sweden.
Never seen one of these.
He is becoming the kind of archetype of sort of aging fat cat Americana.
Yeah, I know. He's the last, again, there's hardly anybody who can play it. I can imagine it back in the day, in the 70s, he would play the young guy. Weirdly, it reminded me, in a way, Kirk Douglas's Lonely Are the Brave had a kind of the sort of desert feel, a different sort of thing. But I, possibly out of a kind of misplaced ancestor worship, I kind of did enjoy this a little bit.
It's strange for Douglas, though, because he did Behind the Candelabra, and I keep coming back to him expecting class.
Yeah.
And he doesn't care a jot.
No, I don't think he does. You
know, that's
like
the problem.
He's an old-school Hollywood wheeler dealer. He just goes where the money is and where he thinks he's going to have some fun.
But he's got that strange thing that a good actor has where you do emotionally invest in them.
Yeah,
and you think, please do another great role. I'm ready for you to be great again. And he's not thinking about us.
Douglas and Irvine playing cat and mouse in the desert there. And it seems that chasing is something of a motif to this week's films, because it is now time to make way for Reese Witherspoon and Sophie Vergara. They're going hell for leather on the road up to Dallas.
Officer Cooper, who stands at 4 feet, 11 inches.
Oh, come on.
The other suspect, a 45-year-old Latina woman.
45? My madre.
Reese Witherspoon is a straight arrow Texas cop. Sophie Vergara is the strutting trophy wife of a Colombian drugs baron. Put them together and yee-haw, there's fireworks and catfights and oh so many comedic misadventures. buckle your seatbelts for a hot pursuit.
You must be Miguel.
See, yeah, yo soy Miguel.
I am totally crushing it as a dude.
Oh yeah, that's your average guy chest.
Nothing there.
Yep, that's right, nothing there.
Peter, you like a good comedy, don't you?
I certainly do. This isn't it. This is really terrible, I have to say, and it gives me no pleasure to say that because Reese Witherspoon, on her day, can play comedy like an absolute master. But there is something very wrong here, really, really wrong. It's not sexy, it's not funny, it's not anything at all. Reese Witherspoon can't be funny, and she can't let her co-star be funny either. I suspect that Sofia Vergara has lots of stand-up material that she can't let rip with, because eventually she has to cede importance to the producer star, i.e. Witherspoon, in every scene and every line. And you can see the defeatedness of that dynamic. It just crushes the life out of it. And of course they get into this sort of cleavage off where Reese has to have a cleavage and she has to have a cleavage. And it, so this really kind of sub Thelma and Louise thing where they go off and they pick up a sexy young guy and all the rest of it is so kind of lame.
And contemptuous.
And really, I want, again, it's not, we always say this, I wanted it to be funny because there are, like, the heat, whatever, there's, you know, the, it can work. It's, but you need lines, you need material, and you need people who know how they're going to play comedy
and chemistry. And, and how
really
they're going
to play off each
other. Chemistry there.
Exactly.
At all.
I mean, the obvious, you know, she's uptight, and Sofia Vergara teaches her to relax and love life and all the rest of it. And yet, there crucially is no way they can make that work comically. There's no way in which they can sort out the status problem because basically Reese is the star. Mm. She has to be the star. But the basic problem persists. She can't really be funny, and she can't let Sophia be funny either. So there's a real problem.
Peter was mentioning Thelma and Louise, but it also reminded me of Midnight Run. And of course, it just makes you think, I want to see Midnight Run again.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just no joke. So it just gets kind of louder and more shrill.
It's just lame, isn't it? After a while, it's lame and strained, and it makes jokes out of lesbianism and Colombian stereotypes and hicks in the countryside.
They tried to seduce me with some lesbian stuff.
I am her lover.
Our favorite position. Ooh la la.
She wanted me, like, in a big way.
It's just really weak, lazy humour. And I think Peter's right. Like, there's an example with another film that Reese Witherspoon's company produced, which was Gone Girl, where she ceded the leading part to Rosamund Pike. Mm. And that was a great movie, and it worked mainly because of David Fincher, but also because Reese Witherspoon had the foresight to say, I'm not going to fit into this role, but I should step back from it. And I think what she's doing with her company, i.e. trying to bring female talent to the fore, give female directors a shot when they wouldn't normally get one, is really admirable, but she has to take her ego out of the equation. Somebody else in this might have done a better job, I think. And I think Sofia Vergara is a great comedy actor. If you watch Modern Family, the TV show that she does, she's hilarious in that. It's a similar kind of play on stereotypes of her nation, but it's clever and funny in the context, well-written. Mm. And the script on this is just dire.
And you can see the way she's dying to get into the material, get into the stand-up, but she's nipped in the bud almost within a few seconds. Yeah. She can't get into it because this is how it works. Mm.
It's only 87 minutes, but it felt like
it felt a lot longer. It felt
like a long, long road trip.
Yeah.
What is that white thing?
Oh, that's my underwear.
It's no underwear, that's a diaper.
Brash, unfunny, and as cold as December. That's Hot Pursuit. And it is at this point that we cast about for a hero to send this week's show out on a proper high, possibly with a bona fide masterpiece. Cometh the hour, cometh Adam Sandler. God knows he's never let us down before. Adam Sandler is the cobbler, possessed of a magical stitching machine and able to literally step into his customer's shoes. One minute he's a smooth Brit, the next he's a local New York thug. He's sticking his feet wherever they'll fit. He'll pick up an infection, but he's still a fun guy.
I'm a woman. Oh, no, I'm not.
Henry, I put it to you that a film that wears too many shoes will eventually go lame.
Yeah, all right, I feel a bit of a heel for saying it, but I kind of liked this.
Yeah?
And
not many others do.
I know. And we were talking a couple of weeks ago about Inside Out and how it's like a Woody Allen setup. And this really is like a Woody Allen setup.
Or like even older, something like a kind of Danny Kaye film.
Yeah. Like New York magic realist kind of thing. Very silly, very zany.
It's a Jewish urban fairy tale.
Yeah, but I quite like Sandler being a schlub. And it's kind of miserable, this as well. And it's got something in whatever kind of ham-fisted way to say about gentrification and tries to make a tiny little political point in there as well. And gives a big, big performance to Method Man in a role that is really difficult for him to play. He basically has to play Adam Sandler, but he does it okay.
What the?
Dan Stevens does too.
And Dan Stevens does well. And it's just, it's genial, this. It's genial and it's sort of light and fun and it's not brash in a way that so many Adam Sandler films are. And it doesn't ask you to fall in love with Adam Sandler himself. He's very much stepping back from it in a way that Reese Witherspoon couldn't.
Is he stepping back too much? I mean, the conceit of the film is that basically he's then played by these other characters. So you almost think, where's he gone?
Yeah.
It's kind of like there's a deficit of Sandler here.
Or on the flip side, it's a massive ego trip because everybody gets to play Adam Sandler and he can watch everyone pay tribute. You know, it's a roast in a way, I guess. I didn't hate it as much as everyone has.
I want to defend him because I sort of think he's the underdog. Everybody kind of gangs up on him and it's become a sort of reflex thing. And I've done my
millionaire underdog.
I've done my share of I've done my share of slagging him off. There's always a moment discussing Adam Sandler where somebody says punch drunk lung and I love and everybody nods sagely and say, yeah, that was the good one. I have to say that baffles the head. That baffles
it's the
me.
Worst Paul Thomas Anderson.
It's the worst Paul Thomas Anderson film, and I didn't think he was very good in it either. But I thought he was good in Funny People, for example, John Lovitar. I thought he was perfectly good in that. And he gave a really interesting insight into what a top flight comedian in his ennui and his increasing detachment from comedy can actually be like. So I kind of want to, as I say, it's slightly absurd, you know, the billionaire underdog, but I think there's a kind of weird ganging up now that happens, critical ganging up.
But it's interesting with, like, he's never done a Chris Rock in that he's never come flatly out with a movie that says, I know that I do crap. I know I do mainstream crap, and I know that this is what you love me for, but I don't want to be doing this anymore.
He's not quite meta. He's never quite sent himself up. He doesn't really self-satirize. Funny People was the nearest he came to it.
You are the cobbler.
You miss it, you okay?
Dead!
Adam Sandler in The Cobbler there. Time now for a few questions. First question. Why does violence fascinate so many filmmakers?
That's an interesting one. I would say violence doesn't fascinate filmmakers. Ultraviolence fascinates filmmakers. The ordinary, banal business of violence, you actually don't see very much. What you see more is, and here's a real cliche, balletic violence. Balletic scenes of violence and gunplay. Mm. Usually a term written by critics who've never seen a ballet or a fight in their life, incidentally. I actually very rarely see something which you think, ugh, in the sense that you would, if you witness an act of violence in real life, it doesn't look anything like.
No, it's banal it's and banal. Sudden.
That's not what it. That's not what violence looks like.
To an extent, I think the technical department like violence as well, mainly because of blood. The way that blood looks on screen. I was thinking of Django Unchained, with the blood splashing across the cotton.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's a very kind of sledgehammery visual image, but it's one that stays with you.
And the last question is, what's your favourite Bond film, theme and Bond?
I like Live and Let Die because I think that the Paul McCartney Wings theme tune for Live and Let Die is absolutely sensational.
Not better than Goldfinger, though, is it?
Well, I think it bears comparison.
It's got that horrible reggae break in the middle.
Yeah, but that's fine. Yeah, but it's so, as our colleague Alexis Petridis wrote about it, he said, it's explosively orchestrated, which it is. I mean, it's absolutely great. So I've got a big soft spot for Live and Let Die.
I think I like Diamonds Are Forever. Even though it's like a real knackered old late Connery Bond.
Yeah.
But it also has that thing of it's almost like the last historical Bond where it's like the late 60s. Everything's kind of breaking down a bit.
Yeah.
He's looking kind of overweight
he's looking
and knackered.
He's looking a bit loose.
Paunchy.
Yeah.
And it's got a kind of horrible dark comedy through it. I really like that one.
I think Sean Connery's the best Bond. I like GoldenEye.
I hated GoldenEye.
Yeah, I thought it was good. Partly because of the computer game, which is fantastic. And then Sean Bean was a great baddie. Was it Famke Janssen playing the fly hugging evil person
on a top or something?
Yeah,
on a top. Oh God,
you're not with me on this.
And with that, I fear that our mission through the Rogue Nation of this week's movie releases is finally at an end. We've been battered and bruised, but I think we're okay. My thanks to Peter and to Henry. Thanks to you for watching and for your questions too. We're back next week.